Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Heather Deaton, Wealth Advisor for Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94 between Highway 164 and Highway F in the Ridgeview Corporate Park, and also in the village of Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank building across from Winkies. We also service clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. You can visit ellenbecker.com for more details. My guest today is Mark Schiller. He's an estate planning attorney, an author, a speaker, and an improv comedian. We may tackle part of that subject in this interview. Mark, welcome. Thanks for joining today.
Glad to be here.
Today we're going to talk about generational wealth and family wealth and your book, How to Not Ruin Your Kids with Money.
That's the book.
So let's just get started. Why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, well, in terms of the estate planning work that I do as a lawyer, that was a late in the game decision for me. I did not grow up wanting to be a lawyer. I don't have lawyers in my family. They're more academics, some inventors. And I just thought it was an interesting area to pursue in terms of education, figure I could do a lot of things with it. And then ended up in the career field. But I think it's really served me well that that was not sort of a passion. Like I had to follow a certain pathway or do things to climb a certain ladder or what have you. And so that led to a more open kind of mindset, I think, in my practice. And also when I started my first private law firm job at a large firm here in town, and then a couple years later, for a variety of reasons, moved to another one that had different approaches. And so as I'm starting to get my sea legs as an attorney, I'm realizing, well, hey, you guys always did it this way. Why do we do it? And the answer was usually, well, that's how we do it. And the other place, well, hey, they did it that way, but you do it this way. Why do you do that? Well, that's how we do it. And so having the experience of seeing people doing things differently kept the, I guess, the practice that much more engaging and interesting and varied. And then you get to really connect with people to figure out, okay, this is why you might go left or right on this issue or that. And you're working with people, which is my favorite part of the job, is you're working with people and generally doing pretty positive things.
Right, exactly. And that's a lot of what we do here with our financial planning and asset management clients, right?
Yeah, is, yeah.
And realizing that you have to be able to do things different and you have to manage your approach for the situation.
No one is the same.
Exactly. So then how did you get to write your book?
Well, it was kind of an accumulation of things over time. As you're working with people, you're seeing how things are going well and how things aren't. And you're looking for stories and examples, and you're being challenged by what you're seeing out there. And ultimately, you're realizing that there's a lot of people who are trying to figure this out who don't all have great resources available to them. There are certainly plenty of good resources out there. There are certainly other people who do this kind of engaging in a family generational transfer kind of thing and do a good job. But to have something that you could just sort of pass along was part of what led to the book. And the other thing was, is in speaking, I could tell some of these things were really resonating. And I was asked to be a part of a seminar for a group of retired business owners.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And we're speaking
on transfer right there.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we're speaking about these topics, and somebody I knew was on the committee to do the programming, and he got back to his committee and said, "Hey, I've got great news. I've got Mark Schiller as our speaker." And they're like, "Who is that?" No idea who I was.
Just wait.
Yeah, right. Well, what they ended up doing is they pulled somebody else in, too, who had a couple of books. And so he ended up speaking for a while. I ended up speaking for a while. We did some Q&A together. It was a lot of fun. And after we're done, he comes up to me kind of as like a drive-by, and he says, "You shouldn't write a book." I'm like, "Oh, that's interesting." And then about 10, 15 minutes later, he's like, "No, you should write a book." And so then it was also – it was helpful because he gave some encouragement, some sort of – a couple of things so you didn't have to stumble right out of the gate.
Right.
And then it just became kind of, how do you put this thing together? You know, what do you want to say? And what I really decided I wanted to say to people is, like, here are some tools – here are some things that I've seen work. If we were sitting in a conference room together, these are the kind of conversations we'd had. And so that's why the book is designed that way, as a conversational kind of piece. But also, even though you have your responsibility, and it really is your job to parent well with whatever wealth you have stewardship over, you're also going to need some help along the way. You're going to need your advisors to help you with the things that you're not, you know, it's just not your cup of tea, right?
Right.
And so how do you work well and keep first things first, as opposed to being distracted by some of the things that people might have a good idea for you, but it may not fit with what your primary goals are?
And that really, you know, wraps around a lot of things that you've probably seen regarding, you know, the kind of a fancy word like family wealth dynamics,
right?
Like how everybody in the family relates to money.
Yeah.
What your money situation is, how you've impacted or haven't impacted your kids with that, trained them or not trained them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all great parts of your book. If you want to share, you know, kind of where did you see that in your practice? How did you start to incorporate more of those soft skills?
Well, you kind of have to. I mean, you can come up with all the best tax planning in the world, but if you saved an extra $10 million of taxes, let's say you could do that, but it was going to ruin your kids, then a good parent would say, well, let's not do that. So by focusing on tax planning, which can be supportive of some of your goals, if it really would undermine it, then you need to keep those primary goals your primary goals. So as you're talking to people about these things and you see what they care about, then you have to lean into it, I think. Because people can come in and they can say, hey, I want to trust. Okay, well, why do we want to trust? What do we want it to look like? What are we trying to accomplish? As opposed to, I have this on my punch list.
Right.
Because I made a New Year's resolution to get a trust, but I don't really know why. And if you don't know why, you tend to delay and procrastinate, or you've done it, you don't feel confident in it. So then a year or two goes by, and whatever peace of mind you felt or satisfaction for getting a task done just evaporates, and now you feel unsettled.
And if you don't know what that means, like, you can learn the definition of a trust, but there's so many decisions in that set of documents about what happens when you're gone.
Right.
What happens to your wealth, to your family,
right,
when you're gone? And those are the decisions that, you know, really have to align with your core values.
They do, because all of a sudden you can get surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I met this morning with somebody who did planning 27 years ago, and it involved a certain estate planning technique when the exemption was very low, $600,000. I mean, that's still, you know, if that fell on the floor, I'd pick it up, but it's a lot different
right.
than $13 million more than that. And they did planning, which basically leads to the house being not their house anymore.
Oh.
A qualified personal residence trust. And it was set up to be a very long-standing kind of thing, which some of them were, and there's some reasons to do that. But all of a sudden, that tax planning objective has been lost in the ether. And now you bring it up again. It's like, oh, okay, you got to do all that backfill. This is why we did this, or this is why it's good, or maybe it's not so good anymore, so what do we do with it?
Right. That's the part where keeping up with what those decisions were along the way,
yeah,
making sure you've got a team that's going to highlight, hey, don't forget some of these changes are coming or have happened or could impact you. Mm-hmm. People's wealth changes along the way too.
Yeah.
You know, for the positive and for the not so positive
right.
too.
Well, and families change.
Right.
Lots
right.
of things change.
That's all part of your book, How to Not Ruin Your Kids with Money, about the transition of wealth, the great wealth transfer. Mm-hmm. That topic is very top of the headlines, you know, in these last few years especially. Mm-hmm. You mentioned taxes and tax planning. You know, those rules change a lot throughout a person's lifetime when people are living so long, too.
Right.
And making these documents when their families are just starting out.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you suggest that people review their plans?
Well, you know, I think the standard answer to that from a lawyer's point of view mm-hmm. is typically touch base every year or two and do a deeper dive every 5 or so. But what seems to happen is as people go, I'm curious what you think about this, but as I've been reflecting on this topic, I feel like life doesn't go in 5-year chunks.
Mm-hmm.
It goes in waves that are more like 10, 15, 20-year waves. And so if you're starting out and you got that first kid coming, okay, you need to do some estate planning for that new circumstance.
Right.
But what's going to be different in 5 years? Well, you might be sleeping better, but outside of that, your estate planning.
You might have a couple more kids.
Maybe a couple more kids. So maybe you're not sleeping better. You're right. You're right. Still going to be bleary-eyed. Get past that so you can think clearly. But that's going to probably be something you look a little bit more when the kids are like in middle school, high school, or maybe even into college, where you would really do some major changes based on the family dynamics. And then if the kids get married, if they have kids of their own, if they sort of move out of state or whatever it is, then in that sort of 20-something, 30-something, you find that there's another stage that happens. And then once you move past that and the kids are more settled, well, now you start looking at what the grandchildren's generation, that's another wage. And then from there, that's where I think the every 2 or every 5 years for someone who's more in that grandparent or retirement mode is probably where it hits a little bit more.
And that leads to what I think our topic will be after our first break here, really about those changes along the way. And as you see your children develop into who they're going to be and the outside forces that will impact who they are and changes that maybe they make in their lifetime as well. And how does a parent and a grandparent really help mold that, again, with some of the tips and strategies in your book about not ruining your kids with money? I love that title. So with that, we'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Heather Deaton, Wealth Advisor with Allen Becker Investment Group, and my guest today is Mark Schiller, estate planning attorney and author of a book named How to Not Ruin Your Kids with Money. It's about transitioning wealth and the great wealth transfer. So, Mark, we had talked in the last segment about, you know, your experience and things that you've seen and what people need to think about as their family ages and grows, their wealth ages and grows, right?
Right.
What are some of the fears that you've heard from when it comes to parents about their kids or even grandparents about their grandkids?
Well, you know, there's, I think everybody seems to have a few kind of horror stories that they're aware of. Somebody who ended up, you know, becoming a trust fund baby or inherited something too soon and it really negatively impacted them, took away their drive. You know, they didn't finish certain, whether it's education or didn't pursue their career with enough intentionality and all that sort of thing. And so there are those cases that at least people would view as, well, they're bad results. And people worry about their kids having bad results.
Right.
And a lot of times it's just because they've seen it elsewhere and it has nothing to do with their own kids. But it's just, could this all go wrong? Because I think a lot of people don't really know, well, how does money impact any of us?
Right.
And so if you don't know, then is it going to be something that all of a sudden shakes somebody out of a good pathway? And so we kind of worry about this unknown fear, like our kids are at risk for money somehow sweeping the legs out from underneath them, and then they're going to fall on their face.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a child who has a good, solid character, if they are pursuing things well, if they're trying to be productive and are serious about their own finances and trying to learn, you probably do have a pretty good recipe for success. But if you don't know, and you only get one shot at raising your kids.
Right. Right.
And it's just, you know, it kind of doesn't matter how many books you read. I mean, they continue to put out books about how to raise your kid, and they keep changing the deal in terms of, like, you know, how do you get them to sleep through the night? All this kind of stuff is different. When it comes to money, I think money is a longer term thing, and money is a magnifier and revealer of character.
Ooh, I like that. Magnifier and revealer of character.
Mm-hmm. So the more money that's involved, the more risk that you have. And so that's why sometimes people are like, well, I'm going to hold it tight, and that way I'm never going to put my kid to the test, and therefore it's not going to go wrong. At some point, that benefit of holding it back kind of leaves off.
Right.
And so you've got to switch the conversation at some point. So part of what I would say is in the book is overcoming that fear, as long as you've got a good baseline. Like I said, if you've got good, decent character, the kids seem to know a little bit about what money is, maybe bring them in with you when you meet with your financial advisor, give them some exposure to some of these kinds of things, share the book with them, see what they think about it, you know, get some conversations going. And if you do, then you can start to see, well, what's going to happen if you do receive whatever that inheritance will be one day. And so, you know, give it a little test run, or at least have a sense of what it is that you're looking at, because now you're taking something that is unknown, a fear of how is this going to work out, and you're starting to expose it a little bit, so it's like you've got some baseline for why things might actually go well. You can guard against what is negative all the time and as hardcore as you want, but you got to leave room for the good stuff.
Right, exactly. And I think you do need to watch for where your kids are very successful in their decisions, right? And be able to find that.
Yeah.
And then build a plan that's going to work with those strengths.
Right.
And work with them as best you can, depending on where they're at in their life, too.
Yeah.
You know, as best you can to kind of encourage and guide and advise, be kind of more of a counselor in their own relationship with money.
Yep. My kids are at the stage where they've been leaving the nest.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, they're all out of the nest. We still have some feathers and all that kind of stuff around the house. But, you know, they're adults, and so they're going to make their own decisions. And some of it is just like when they're smaller. You got to let them make their own decisions, and they might make some mistakes.
Right.
But the key is, well, how do you recover from whatever those quote-unquote mistakes might be? Mm-hmm. Or what, when life throws you a curveball, how are they going to respond?
Right.
There's a proverb that I like to reflect back. It's about a monk who's walking along the path and sees a monarch butterfly trying to come out of the chrysalis. And it's struggling, and he has compassion on it. So he takes a knife out and cuts a slit so that the monarch can just climb right out. Well, what happens when the monarch is coming out is the liquid is pushing into the wings to straighten them out. And if you take the struggle away, the wings don't straighten out and you can't fly. So part of what I think we need to do as parents is not just try to make it happen, because you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Your kid's success is going to be your kid's success. You can facilitate it. You can give them advice. You can cheer them on when things go well and pick them up and dust them off a little bit when things go poorly.
Yep.
But ultimately, if they're going to fly, it's going to be on them and trusting that they have the ability to do that and to do well with whatever they are entrusted with from you or otherwise, I think is actually part of them being successful.
Mm-hmm. If they've never had to make a decision on their own.
Right.
They're not, they don't have the experience.
They don't have the skill set for it. They don't have the confidence in it. And they get the yips when it comes to finances.
It's all based on balls, right?
That's right.
So I think, you know, thinking about that, like some of these fears and, mm-hmm. yes, yeah, some are justified and, you know, seeing changes that can come in along the way. Again, outside influences. You know, we're talking as if it's children that are in the nest, leaving the nest,
right.
just getting started. And there's also changes along the way
yeah.
that happen within and inside of families.
Yes.
You know, when they marry, when they mm-hmm. make big financial decisions, you know, mm-hmm. with a spouse that maybe has a different relationship with money, has a different background with money.
Right.
You know, I would think that would be a turning point as well.
Yeah, because it's, you know, I think you use the word family dynamics mm-hmm. when it comes to wealth somewhere in there. And a lot of those dynamics are, it's not like A plus B equals C with that. Mm-hmm. It just sort of changes the room a little bit.
Right.
And so how do you describe what's different in the family ecosystem that you have?
Mm-hmm.
And then people over time will choose to let the in-laws in more, some fully, and some will keep them on the outside.
Right.
And then what does that do within that child's family ecosystem as well? But at some point, a family has its own core and its own sense of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can figure that out, if you can lean into it, then you're probably not fighting the current as much.
Right.
And that just takes time, it takes conversation, it takes trust.
That's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm.
And authenticity. You know,
yeah.
if you think you've got it all together and your kids think you are full of it, then you've got to deal with that, because no matter what you say, they're not going to believe you.
Right.
And so having real honest conversations is part of how you not ruin the relationships, how you not ruin your own financial strength, all
mm-hmm.
those sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Is there a point, like we were just talking about how as the family grows, ages, mm-hmm. Whatever we want to think of it for that, is there a point where it's too late to make any of these, to influence this in any way?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny. You know, I chose the title that I chose and was kind of surprised it wasn't out there, but it generates a bit of an emotional reaction to
mm-hmm.
people. And one of the things that I hear back from a lot of people is, well, kind of in a joking way, I think, normally, is, well, it's too late for me. You know, should have given this book to me 20 years ago or something
mm-hmm.
like that. And, I mean, we do, as humans, change less later in life. In fact, I kind of break down sort of the maturation process into three. You know, when they're minors and, you know, really
mm-hmm.
little kids, that's one stage. And then there's that stage where they're maturing. They're
mm-hmm.
developing into who they're going to be. And then the last one is when they're mature, or at least for the most part, as mature as they're likely to get. But that's on a broad-based kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You
sure.
know, most 50-somethings who are terrible with money and kind of spendthrift and all that kind of stuff are probably going to be that way when they're 60. But any one individual is not necessarily going to turn out that way. You can make pivots.
Sure.
And
mm-hmm.
part of what I think is a pivot, at least when there's money involved, more, you know, maybe a little bit more than a couple bucks, is being shown some confidence that you might not have been. Because I think a lot of times when people are not as solid with money as you would expect them to be based on their, you know, maybe sort of personal intelligence, maybe sort of the way they interact with the world generally, sometimes it's working some things out, expressing
mm-hmm.
some things, some self-doubt that was placed there or at least perceived, a lot of times unconscious,
right,
you know, I'm not
right.
a psychologist, but you see these things working themselves out. And so can you reverse that? Can you get under whatever that root cause is? And so one of the ways I think some of those 50 or 60-somethings can be, rehabilitated is not the right word, but just sort of have the ability to have the kind of success they would have is, look, you're going to have the biggest impact on the third generation,
right.
the grandchildren. And so, you know what? I trust you to be able to do that. and I'll work together with you. Maybe I had my part in this not going as well as it should, but we both care about our grandchildren, your children, so let's work on this together. And I think that can be a pretty empowering thing. So I don't think the answer is it's ever too late.
Right.
At least, you know, we should always keep an openness towards things turning around.
Well, and having that authentic and real conversation too.
Yep.
You know, and calling people in.
Yeah.
Right? Calling kind of out what the past may have been, but really calling it in as how can we move forward.
And this is a big difference that I think in the last 5 years that I've been seeing. The folks who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe into early 80s, are now more open to having fuller conversations than I think 10 years ago or 20 years ago, people at that same point in life would have been.
Sure.
So yeah, so that gives, I think, a greater chance for things to go well than might have been the case if we were doing this conversation 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, with that, we're going to take a short break, and we will be right back with Mark Schiller. Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Heather Deaton, wealth advisor at Ellen Becker Investment Group. My guest today is Mark Schiller. He's an estate planning attorney. He's a speaker. He's an improv comedian, but he's on the show today because he wrote a book called How to Not Ruin Your Kids with Money. So, Mark, we've talked a lot about, you know, what led you to the book, your past experience, your lived experience, what you've seen and probably felt, right, as fears about that wealth transfer within families. I think sometimes people think, well, there's not going to be anything left by the time I'm gone. So what does it even matter?
Right.
That's one end of the spectrum, right? If I had a lot more money, I would be more worried about this.
Yeah.
Whatever happens when I'm gone is just what happens when I'm gone. So how do you approach this when it comes to the level of wealth that we're talking about, when it comes to, I'm using, you know, air quotes, this great wealth transfer? Mm-hmm. How much is enough to have an impact? How much is so much that there's little you can do?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, I think it was in the 70s when they had that book, Die Broke.
Yes.
And the idea was... Yeah, spend it all or whatever.
Right. If we only knew the exact timing, it would make all these planning opportunities that much easier.
And
but we don't.
We don't know. And we also live in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And people in the Midwest typically don't spend crazy.
Uh-huh, sure.
And so to spend yourself down to zero, you would feel guilty. You would feel awful about yourself. So people,
we're Midwest nice.
People don't tend. Well, we also want to be modest. We don't want to be flashy.
Right, right.
So we tend to have a few more bucks in the bank maybe than maybe it would be true elsewhere. I think, you know, in terms of what is the amount where you could do damage? That was your question, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think there's an element of at what level does somebody get excited about the number? And it's different for different people.
Sure.
So if somebody is like, you know, I mean, you know, we all like to receive gifts. Mm-hmm. But if a $50,000 number would have whoever the recipient would be kind of falling over, fainting, and just, I mean, just overwhelmed by it, then that's enough to do damage.
Right.
Because if you have the ability to have sort of the capacity, which is one of the terms I use, you know, for financial maturity, having the character, the competence, the ability to manage it, but also the capacity, sort of the spiritual, emotional ability to hold a certain level of wealth without feeling like you're either guilty or you're going to crash this thing into a brick wall or whatever it is. That's where you feel a little unsteady, and that's where you can find yourself doing some damage, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to do a lot of damage or to start down a path with even a very small amount if you don't have some guardrails, if you don't deal with the issues that may cause you to overemphasize or to outspend or whatever it is. So you want to be careful with it. I think people sometimes have a sense of it, but the flip side of it, I think people tend to minimize how much damage the money they have could actually do.
Okay.
Because when they think about themselves, everybody thinks, not everybody, but most people would think, you know, I'm pretty simple. You know, I have enough to pay attention to, but I'm not some millionaire. And sometimes the people who say that are millionaires when you put the net worth statement on
exactly.
the board, right?
Yeah, numbers add up.
Right. You got 1.6 in your IRA. You are a millionaire. Yeah. I'm sorry to report to you. So you got to think about that way. But because we don't want to think of ourselves as outside of our culture, I guess, you know, which we think of ourselves as more modest. If you think of yourself as middle class, that has certain connotations. If you think of yourself as having a certain level of wealth that's appropriate or money has its sort of, unhealthy side. Maybe that's the way some wealthier characters are portrayed on television shows or whatever it is. We try to minimize what it is that we have, which means we tend to under-steward. We under-plan for the wealth that we do have. And that's a challenge for financial planning. That's a challenge sometimes for tax planning. That's a challenge for estate planning because I just want to do simple. And some of that may be that you are understating it or it's just, well, I don't want to think too hard about this stuff because I don't want to feel stupid about it. I worry that that keeps people from getting into some of these conversations because it does get technical.
Right. And if they feel not being met at where they actually know and educated on it and brought through the process, they're talked over their head.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't lead to an engaging conversation with that client who's got to make decisions.
Right.
Right. If they're, you know, afraid to ask questions or they respond to something and they don't really understand what they just chose.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
I had a couple that I worked with and we met and we talked about what they wanted to do for their estate plan. And we put the trust in, you know, other documents together. And we had a follow-up meeting, and we talked about some of the open questions. And then we made some changes, and we're ready to sign. So we're there to sign. And it was the wife in this case. She said, I have a few questions before we start. Okay. So we go through those, answer all those fine. And you ready to sign? And she's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I was so worried about this meeting. I'm like, what do you mean? I thought we were doing fine, you know? And she said, I just felt so stupid on this stuff. And I never want anybody to feel that way. So we put together a resource called The Little Book of Estate Planning. It's just a sort of those baseline questions. And that's something, you know, it's at markschiller.com if people want to get that. But it's basically what are those baseline questions that we all have that can give us a foundation. And when we look at the book, in some ways, it's a broader and a fuller conversation about how do we engage in this whole activity when it comes to what our kids are. And some of not being stupid on this stuff. I'm using it, you know, that's sort of a harsh word in its own way, but it is kind of how we feel, and it keeps us from engaging sometimes in the process. Part of the way to not feel stupid is to remember what it is that's important to you and to take a breath and think, how does this tie with what is most important to me? And talk to your advisor who's helping you with these things, but how does this help? And so you may not understand why you have this certain investment mix in your account, or you may not know why this particular anti-alienation provision is included in your trust. And you don't have to, but if you see something that doesn't make sense, can you get an answer that shows that the person that you're working with has heard you, understands what it is you're trying to accomplish, can tell you why it's there, and even if you can hold on to that just for a moment in time, you will realize that you have asked for something to meet a need, and just like when you go to a doctor.
Right.
You don't know why this particular chemo treatment has worked. I mean, maybe you hit WebMD and annoyed your doctor about it. But you've got to trust the professionals to help you. But you still have to advocate for yourself.
And, you know, listening is how Ellenbecker leads, right? We lead with listening, meeting people where they're at. I love to answer questions and help people understand to the level where they feel comfortable.
Right.
Right. Some people want to know every single detail, and maybe they move on and set it aside from there. But that is what gave them the confidence and the comfort mm-hmm. to trust the plan.
Yes.
Right. And the guarantee about a plan is that it's never going to go exactly how it's set at the beginning.
Right.
So that's where, you know, being able to shift and weave when life takes over,
yep.
when the different things that are great, the different things that are less great mm-hmm. happen in your life. Same thing with estate planning, too.
Yeah, have your North Star, have that clear, and then look from time to time, are you still on course? And do you need to, you know, put the rudder a little to the left or to the right?
Exactly. Okay, we're time for another break. This has been really great, Mark, so we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Heather Deaton, wealth advisor here at Ellenbecker Investment Group. And my guest today is Mark Schiller. He's an estate planning attorney and an author. One of his books that we're talking about today is How to Not Ruin Your Kids with Money. So, Mark, we've talked about so much about family, wealth, and mm-hmm. dynamics, and guiding and coaching kids and bringing them into the conversation.
Right.
So, you know, for my family, our kids are in college.
Okay.
Several years ago, we brought them into the conversation, but not about where we're at with our savings and investments and net worth, but more about cash in, cash out.
Okay, good.
So we started by showing them yeah. all the bills that we spend on.
Okay.
And then showed them what kind of income comes in. So
yeah.
it was a level set
okay.
of, you know, because they were young and it's dollars that, mm-hmm. you know, for a 12-year-old is hard to see what a professional salary would be like.
Sure.
So, you know, in our situation, what are some ways that you've seen work when it comes to sharing that net worth side of things?
Yeah.
When you've got, say, the kids that are, you know, starting their own journey,
mm-hmm.
and we can even talk about younger and older ones too,
mm-hmm.
but let's start with, you know, my own personal situation.
Right, right. Well, I think, you know, that is a sort of a stage of life where there are some natural discussions to happen. And you do have to contextualize things to where people are at. Like my second son, at some point, I think he was like 9 or 10. He goes, how much you make, Dad?
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And I'm like, the fact that you're asking means I am not going to answer this question for you. because, you know, like you said, they have to have a certain scope to
right.
it, right? You know, what is a dollar?
Right.
What does that mean? What goes into having it? All those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to expand the conversation as you go. And so what we did when it came to sort of expanding it was to put them in charge of more and more
mm-hmm.
as they got into their teen years.
Yeah.
And then as they got into college, we wanted them to have a financial participation in the decision about where they went. And there's different ways to do that. And there's not a right or a wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
But it is real money being spent, and now is a time for them to have some sense of what is going into this, because if they don't value what, if you're contributing every single dollar, if you're going to do that, you want your children to value the experience
right.
and treat it with the kind of respect and effort and energy that should go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a summer camp for 4 years, right?
Right.
If it is, then stop writing those checks, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, so I think what you did was a good thing where you started to show some of the spending, the ins and outs, probably earlier on the income disclosure than I think most people would do or feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
But you've also got to know your kids.
Right.
It's easier for some to disclose earlier and not so much for others. And you also have to think about the sibling group. You know, so your kids are how far in age apart?
They are almost 2 years apart in age.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a family that has kids 15 years apart,
right.
what you tell the older one may filter down to the younger one who may not have the capacity really to take that
mm-hmm.
information in. And maybe they keep it secret or whatever. But where I would say the disclosure of, let's say, net worth aspects start to come in is probably somewhere toward the later stage of where the children's group is getting to that mature point in time. So that's probably more in the kind of late 20s, early 30s, maybe even a little bit past that. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, the disclosure becomes that much more important because people tend to rely on their children to assist if they have any sort of limitation themselves in terms of managing things in the event of an incapacity or some other difficulty. And then it's also that much more real at some point that it's going to turn over. And if you leave it open, what I have found, I share this in the book, and I guess the more money that's involved, the more they people can guess wrong. But people tend to guess what their parents' net worth might be based on what they see their parents spending.
Oh, sure.
So if you don't, if you spend below your means, your kids are probably guessing that your net worth is something much lower than what it is that you have. So when it comes, it's a surprise and maybe a shock, and maybe you're not ready for it. You know, and I mean, what level gets to shock will vary person by person, right? But if you leave it open and you don't know, and all of a sudden, well, that's two or three times. It's like when you find that $20 bill in your winter coat, which people are going to start doing right now. That 20 gets spent very quickly. Not so much the one that you had in your wallet the week before you pulled your winter coat out.
Well, and when you don't, when you spend less than what you bring in, then you have an accumulation. And that's how people have saved a lot. Many of our clients have portfolios that are the size they are because they're just the what they value, and what their spending is. We encourage our clients to spend. The children that think their parents don't have any money and then they inherit more than they thought they would. That's a whole other side. Where that grown child is, you know, saying, I just wish they would have spent this. I just wish they would have done more for themselves. So I think you're right, like having those conversations earlier, right before it's too late for them to enjoy parts of life that they just feel like they don't want to. They want to take care of their families. Again, their own core values. That can really take out, just take away some of that kind of rub at the end, where the kids feel conflicted based on what the parents' decisions had been. We have family meetings with our clients and their grown children all the time here, and it's to start that conversation about what is this right now, what are we going to do along the way, and what happens down the road.
Anything to get those conversations happening, as long as you don't start too early, because sometimes the knowledge of money is the same as having it. So if you're not ready to have it, maybe you're not ready to know about it.
Yeah, that's true.
But at some point, that's going to turn. And to have those conversations is going to give you a higher probability of having good results.
We certainly don't want our kids watching everything we spend and thinking that it's theirs that you're spending.
Then you got a different problem.
That's a different problem.
Can we get rid of the donut of the month club, please? What's going on here, kids?
Exactly. So, Mark, this has been great. If our listeners want to, you know, find out more about you, see the books that you have written, where can they find you?
Well, the book's on Amazon and all the other places. There's an audio version on Audible, an ebook version, if you have a Kindle kind of thing. You can go to markschiller.com. There's a place for you to order the books there and a bunch of articles. Actually, that kind of was a little bit of a starter kit for the book to kind of play around with a few kind of blog post-sized articles on things. So haven't been as active with that, but probably will be now that the book is out there a little bit more. So that'd be another good place to go.
That's good. And how about your improv comedy? Where can we find your improv comedy?
Well, I'm with a group called Fish Sticks Comedy. Fishstickscomedy.com is where that's at. I had started at Comedy Sports in Milwaukee, which is a great place, still going strong. I think they're at 40 years or so plus,
something like that.
So I was with them from 01 to my last show in 2009, but Fish Sticks has been since 2007, and got people kind of across the country in that too, so it's a fun thing.
Oh, that's great. Well, again, thank you so much. I've loved this conversation. You can remember that
Money Sense airs Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. and Sundays from 12 to 1 p.m. If you've enjoyed today's show and you want to learn more about Ellen Becker Investment Group and our upcoming events, you can visit us at ellenbecker.com or give us a call at the office at 262-691-3200. As always, I hope that I've made a difference in your personal and financial well-being. And remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest, we always listen.